Whatever else the hit single Space Oddity had done for David Bowie, it hadn't given him any more positive motivation. In fact, as things turned out, the money that he made from the record eventually helped to subsidize inactivity.
When I had that Space Oddity record out, I was still a little Cockney Dylan, and I was going out into ballrooms and playing to pretty rock and roll audiences, and the outcome was not what I expected. I didn't expect any outcome, really, but what I got was sort of cigarettes and things. It wasn't nice. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't the papers. So I stopped doing it. I just gave up for a bit.
The original momentum, however, and the pressure from the record company were directed towards the making of an album. Tony Visconti.
But when it came time to make the album, I figured that I had let David down by saying that I didn't believe in Space Oddity, and I assumed that he'd want to continue working with Gus. But he came right back to me and he said, "Well, I've got that out of the way. Will you please make the album with me now?" And I didn't know what to do. David's really a very forgiving person. He still is that way. And I think I appealed to his, I told him exactly why, logically why I didn't want to do it, and because it was on a logical level, I think David didn't take it personally. And I was asked to do the album. I think the very first track we did was Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed, that one. David had all those songs written, and the year and a half, actually, that was a very lean period. Nobody wanted to know David. He had more than enough material for an album, and the Space Oddity album was drawn from that material. Nothing was written especially for it.
The Rolling Stones had just had their 14th hit with Honky Tonk Woman. The track that Tony Visconti mentioned was very Stones-ish. Slightly Dazed, written and performed by David Bowie on that Space Oddity album. And just as he'd helped on the Space Oddity single, Rick Wakeman was called in again.
Tony Visconti phoned me up and said he was doing what was then going to be the follow-up album, which was just called David Bowie on Phillips, which later became the Space Oddity album. And he said, "David, I'd like to do some keyboards." And I went along and did that, thoroughly enjoying myself, had a good time talking to David, because he was writing songs that I thought were absolutely fantastic. I remember coming away, and right to this day I think that Wild Eyed Boy from Free Cloud is one of the classic songs of all time.
Gus did a quick version for the B-side while they were doing the Space Oddity sessions. Paul Buckmaster just came in with his cello and David played it straight off, and they recorded it in 20 minutes or so. But I love that song, I told David I think it really deserves an orchestral treatment, like on a symphonic level, and I re-recorded it for the album.
Solemn-faced, the village settles down, undetected by the stars. And the hangman plays the mandolin before he goes to sleep. And the last thing on his mind is the wild-eyed boy in prison, beneath a covered wooden shaft. Holds the road to its land. Ghosts climb up smoulders, blankets smoke into the room. And the day will end for some of us. As the night begins for one.
The Space Oddity album was a very mixed bag. There were outstanding tracks, there were very poor ones too. Some even harked back to those early DRAM days.
I think Letter to Hermione, that one, was where he got out his newly voice again, which I loved, and I used to... When he sang with his Cockney accent, he would sound like Newly, but when he dropped the accent but sang with that same quality, he had this remarkable, rich, mature voice that very few rock singers have. And I've always encouraged him to use that voice whenever he can, you know, just because it's so unusual. and he still uses it nowadays. He sings a bit deeper now, like Golden Years, he brings it out again, but he's dropped the Cockney accent, you know.
Tony Visconti, again. Tony and David Bowie were as much together outside the studio too, and David was getting him involved in a dozen different projects.
Just after Space Oddity, I mean, he was always a bit of a revolutionary thinker. He said, oh, I could see this this arts lab happening. Arts labs were just springing up around the country. And he started up the Beckenham Arts Lab. And he put a lot of talent and effort into it and organized it. I mean, he was booking artists there. Every week he was on the phone booking artists for it. And he'd go and do his own spot in an effort to keep the Arts Lab supplied with talent. And he even got me to do a few spots. He encouraged me to write songs and get up there and sing. And he tried to make the Arts Lab branch out into drama and other areas, and making lithographs. Well, David's excellent at that. But it never happened because of the, you know, everyone was just sort of in awe of David. It turned out is David's appreciation society. All the local Beckenham kids would just come to the Arts Lab every week really just to see David's set and sort of talk to him and be close to him after the set was over, because he just had that hit record. And he curled his hair and he looked really great. And it was a great time for him, you know. But as soon as he saw that, it took him about 4 months to realize that that was a complete bust, and he gave it all up.
Space Oddity never did establish Bowie as a personality. But just as the hit required a follow-up album, so a follow-up single was eventually called for. Bowie's first manager, Ken Pitt.
It was all decided that London by Tata was going to be the next David Bowie release. To my absolute horror, someone from Philips was on the phone to me one day and happened to mention David's next single, The Prettiest Star. I said, no, it's not Pretty Star, it's London by Tata. And he said, no, it's Pretty Star. And I discovered that there had been a lot of pressure put on behind my back to get The Pretty Star put out. I had a vested interest in The Pretty Star in that David, by way of a present, had given me the publishing rights to it. So I would have been delighted to have seen it released. But I was not concerned with the publishing, but getting a hit record, and I thought that London by Tata was by far and away the best. I don't know how this came about, but suddenly I realized it was too late to reverse this decision that had been made for me. And so The Prettiest Star was released and died. It was a dreadful death.
Ken Pitt was slowly losing touch with his artist. Bowie was moving into a different phase, one in which there was no room for a manager. He decided that The Prettiest Star was his choice for a single.
I did that with old Bowley. Mark was just sort of going through the stumbling of learning to play lead guitar, and I liked some of the mistakes he was making, and I asked him if he'd come along and play lead guitar on it. I like guitarists who make a lot of mistakes, and Mark was making a lot of mistakes those days, and he produced a beautiful solo, and we lost the tapes. It only came out at once. It was my first slip disc. It came out after Space Oddity. But the tapes disappeared, the master tapes.
Pretty star. take us all away, all because of what you are. The prettiest song.
Star with Mark Bolan on guitar. By now, with some of the proceeds from Space Oddity, David had moved from his mother's house in Bromley to a large Victorian flat in Beckenham. Haddon Hall, it was called. He'd met Angie, the girl he eventually married. And as the flat was such a large one, Tony Visconti and his girlfriend moved in as well.
Yeah, I was going, making trips up to London every day when I was doing my other people like Mark Bolan and Mr. Orbs I was working with. And then the whole idea was that by living together, David was going to write more and the productions would be that much better, but that's what never happened in the end. The idea was to create an ideal musical situation.
In that year, 1970, there were three singles out. Each one was quickly forgotten. David and Tony seemed to be spending more time talking about projects than really getting down to them successfully.
He really did not know what he wanted to do. At the end of the whole Space Oddity album, we said, right, this is not the direction to go in, because for such a good single, the album did absolutely nothing. And David said, right, what I have to do is form a group.
The group that eventually came together was based on two groups from East Yorkshire, the Rats and the Roadrunners. It featured Mick Ronson guitar, Woody Woodmansey drums, and Tony, who was on electric bass. They were to stay together for a year and record The Man Who Sold the World. But their first gig ever was for John Peel's Top Gear, and as Bowie remembers, it wasn't all that good.
We rehearsed in the morning and did the show very badly. And then a couple of weeks later started working as a band called Hype. And we did the Roundhouse. Oh, we bombed at the Roundhouse. Mark Bolan was the only person that clapped. He stood in the front with, he bought one of those funny little plastic, like Caesar's, one of the Romans' chest plates. It was sort of elastic bands. He got it from Woolworths and he wore that and a funny helmet and all these sort of Sid Barrett hair coming up. And stood in the front and clapped. Quite rightly so. I mean, we were all wearing Dan Dare outfits, I think, and Superman stuff. I don't know what we were doing there. We were right out of things. It was all Man Who Sold the World and Terror. Sound-wise, it sort of fitted in with the Roundhouse, but visually, of course, it was right up the wall.
It was the predecessor performance to glam rock. Angie suggested that instead of going on in jeans, which every group did in those days, she said, I used to be in the theater and did costumes and all that. Let me sew together some costumes. So for that gig, David went as Rainbow Man. He wore some leotards, and Angela sewed all sorts of diaphanous scarves to his costume and all that. And he went as Rainbow Man. And I went as Hype Man. And I wore like a Superman costume with a big flowing cape and little silver knickers. And Mick Ronson went as Gangster Man, which added up to sort of a gold lamé suit, but cut in the Al Capone style, you know. And I don't know what Woody went as, but we went on the stage, dressed outlandishly like this, and half the place absolutely roared with enthusiasm, and the other half of the place just was absolutely stunned. They couldn't believe, no one had ever done this in those days, and everyone was going on stage in jeans, you know.
Oh, my love, Janine, I'm helpless for your smile. Like a foolish wanderer, I travel ever homeward to your land. The world is not just for the jewels that hold your hand. They're just friends, demons, to a
complicate my mind. Scarcely in the bloom, your twins, and I'll have to keep you in place. Oh, go to the fence, I've got to keep my veil on my face. What's your name? What's your name? You'd like to know me well, but I've got things inside my head that I can't face. What's your name?
Track from the Space Oddity album, Janine. By now, even with a group living as a cooperative at Hatton Hall, Bowie was no nearer to finding any real success. He continued to get involved in pursuits that led to dead ends. His fickleness, though, was to make some sort of sense eventually.
Really, it's an integral part of what I do now, but it's honed itself a little, and it's a little more sophisticated, I guess, and a bit more mature. But I've still got that same erratic sort of faddy thing about me. I mean, I still get turned on by something for only a couple of weeks and then I drop it like I've forgotten about it a couple of weeks later. I went crazy over Man Ray photographs at one time, black and white photographs, and that lasted about a month. And for me, it was the only thing, and I threw everything away. I started taking Man Ray pictures and then I changed my mind, and I always supported myself with a reason why I changed my mind. But now I've realised that I just changed my mind a lot. I always tried to give it a reason before, and that was, I didn't realise that it was that I'm just by nature a very flighty person, but I get turned on and off things all the time very quickly. And having accepted that, it's a lot easier to live with it. And I realise, and everybody laughs at me, the band know what I'm like. And, oh, Bowie's on a new kit this week, I've always got something. Yes, it's not a... Hey, this is great. But I know that I'm not going to have sustained interest in it. Except with people, there's people that mean a lot to me.
Bowie was going through a lengthy phase of re-evaluation during those years. Was he coming to any conclusions, though?
I thought, well, here I am, I'm a bit sort of mixed up creatively. I've got all these things going I like doing at once on stage or whatever. I'm not quite sure if I'm a mime or a songwriter or a singer. Or do I want to go back to painting again? Why am I doing any of these things anyway? And I realised it was because I wanted to be well known, basically. And that I wanted to be thought of as somebody who was very much a trendy person, rather than a trend. I didn't want to be a trend. I wanted to be the instigator of new ideas. I wanted to turn people onto new things and new perspectives. I always wanted to be that sort of catalytic kind of thing. And so I had to govern everything around that. And I just pulled myself in and decided to use the easiest medium to start off with as rock and roll, and then add bits and pieces to it over the years. So that really, by the end of it, I was my own medium. I mean, that'll happen hopefully one day. That's sort of my That's why I do it all, is to become a medium.
The Man Who Sold the World was being made in the early months of 1971, an album that was to create a lot of problems, one way or another, and was destined to be probably the least successful of all his records from a sales point of view.
It was a very difficult album to make. Unlike Space Oddity, all the songs were completed for Space Oddity. We went in to make that album with only one finished song, and that was The Width of a Circle. It was the only song David wrote for that album. And that was the very first thing we recorded. All David had for the rest of the album was just a few titles and a few chord changes. The Man Who Sold the World, he gave us these chord changes to a song called The Man Who Sold the World. Then when we recorded it and David finally wrote the words to that song, he changed the name of that song to The Savior Machine. And in fact said, well, I still like that title, The Man Who Sold the World, so I think I'll write a song called The Man Who Sold the World. The whole of the album was written and recorded piecemeal, with Bowie doing a lyric here, a music line there, and Mick Ronson and Tony Visconti arranging and recording as they went along. It sounds like it was a lot of fun. It sounds that way now, but actually it was a very hair-raising experience, because I was being the producer of the album. I had to bring this album home on a certain budget, on a certain date, and here we were going in, you know, the studio was booked, and we were going into the sessions with no more than a few chord changes, and we didn't have the sort of opulent budget that it takes to make a Sgt. Pepper album. We didn't have 8 months to make this album. We only had about 3 weeks at the most.
It was a nightmare, that album. I hated the actual process of making it. I'd never done an album with that kind of professionalism, and that scared me a lot. I thought it was all sort of, you know, I felt it invalid somehow. I wish we were doing it on four track at the time. We were on eight tracks, and it all seemed too glossy. And also the subject matter was very telling for me. It was all family problems and analogies put into science fiction form.
It seemed a more mature exploration of the moods and themes of earlier years when you first encountered the German philosophers.
I was still sort of going through the thing where I pretending I understood Nietzsche, and it was my Nietzschean effort. A lot of them come out of trying to simplify books that I'd read for myself and trying to understand them, and then put them in. It was probably Zarathustra or something that I'd read, Beyond Good and Evil and something. And I tried to translate it into my own terms to understand it, and so Superman came out of that. So it was sort of, it's pre-fascist. I mean, it wasn't a fascist song, but it was very much a German romantic thing.
Once the album had been made, the group broke up. Going north to a gig in Manchester, Mick Ronson and Woody Woodmansey had seen a sign for Hull and home and taken it. Visconti too had had enough and decided to concentrate on Bolan. But we had a surprise up his voluminous sleeve for all of them, though. When the album came out, its cover, back and front, featured him long-haired and wearing a dress.
Well, that was a stab at being a pre-Raphaelite. That was my Gabriel Rossetti look. But it wasn't worth telling anybody that, so I said it was drag.
I left him when this album was mixed and all that. I had never seen the cover, and I never knew he was going to do this. I really didn't know what was going on. You know, I wanted to contact him again, but there was certain reasons why we couldn't get together again, because of all this bitterness about the group breaking up and this and that. But when I did meet him a few years later, about a year or two later at Trident Studios, and he came up to me in six-inch heels and his hair all dyed red and all that, and it certainly wasn't the Bowie I left in Haddon Hall. He seemed perfectly at ease and almost this look of relief on his face that he's doing all this, you know. It's more so being outrageous than being bisexual. He always wanted to be outrageous, and in fact, he invited a lot of outrageous-looking people to our flat, which is another reason why we left, because I couldn't put up with this constant parade of freaks coming in and out of our house. But as soon as someone would leave, David would say, if someone combed his hair back in a sort of teddy boy style, but as soon as the person was out the door, David would rush to the loo and get a brush and start combing his hair in that style to see how it would look on him. He was definitely searching for an image in those days. So I knew he was going to come up with something, and it was sort of a combination of everything. You know, sometimes Lindsay Kemp, his mime teacher, would come with an assorted variety of strange friends. They would come to the house, and we'd have four or five really weird-looking people there. And when they'd leave, David would try everyone's guise in the mirror himself. He'd dress up as this and that. And he was always looking. And it initially emerged with this album cover, which incidentally was changed very quickly. Mercury in the States thought this album cover was far too outrageous, and they got somebody to just draw sort of a Zap-Pal comic book kind of cover, very quick one. They wouldn't have any men wearing dresses on their covers in the States.
David had married Angie in March the previous year, and now they had a young son, Zoe. So he had a permanent home, a wife, and a son. All he needed was for someone to come along and point him in a more positive direction.
Somebody did come along, and grabbed me by the empty wallet and said, "I'm Tony DeFries and I'm going to make you a star." I said, "Oh, yeah." And he did. So they say, I've read about it. Yeah, that's when Tony DeFries entered my life. And me wallet.
Tony DeFries was just what Bowie needed, a manager with big ideas and an uncomplicated attitude towards success. With record deals renegotiated by DeFries, Bowie was quickly into the new album, one that in every way reflected a newfound confidence and was to break a 2-year run of failure. Mick and Woody came down from Hull again and brought with them Trevor Boulder. Things were underway at last.
A very optimistic album, that was. Hunky Dory was an upper. Just moved to Haddon Hall in Beckenham, the borough of Beckenham, and Angie was with me and collected all my friends. And I just got back. I think I got back from America. And Tony DeFries had sort of appeared on the scene, and everything seemed all systems go after the struggle of Man Who Sold the World. Hunky Dory was the album that said, "Yes, all right, I understand what I've got to do now."
So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others receive Baker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it. Turn and face the strain. Change it.
Don't wanna be a richer man. But never leave the stream of warm permanent sand. So the days flow through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on and say try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware what they're going through.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain. Change it. Don't tell them to grow up out of it. Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it. When you sing your blessings up to her next to this, darling, change it. You can this time. Strange fascination by today.
Most significant, most relevant of Bowie's songs. It remains the first true revelation of his very nature, the butterfly at his best, and acknowledging the conflictions within himself.
Yeah, that was exactly. I mean, that's the kind of song that where I was sort of putting it all together in its different parts. And I realised I was a sack of things.
Another of the songs on that album had been originally released by Peter Noon. Oh, You Pretty Things. Peter's version was rather lightweight compared to the one that wound up on Hunky Dory, though.
The crack in the sky, a hand coming through the crack in the sky, is more what it's about than Pretty Things. It was, it's the more down-to-earth me sort of looking at the poser, David Bowie. It's a lot of the songs, in fact, do deal with some kind of schizophrenia or alternating id problems, and Pretty Things was one of them. The sky, the crack in the sky is always, I mean, Jung, according to Jung, it's to see cracks in the sky is not really quite on. I, the sky for me represented something solid that could be cracked. I still had a dome over the world, which again, I found out was just my own repressions. Yeah. I haven't been to an analyst, no. No, my parents went, and my brothers and sisters and whatever, and aunts and uncles and cousins, and they did that, and they ended up much worse state, so I stayed away. I thought I'd write my problems out, really.
Up your sleepy head, put on some clothes, shake off your bed, put another log on the fire for me, I'll make some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window, what do I see? Crack in the sky and a hand reaching down to me. All the nightmares came today, it looks as though they're here to stay. What are we coming to? No room for me, no fun for you. I think about a world to come where the books were found by the golden ones, written in pain, written it all by a puzzled man who questioned what we were here for. All the strangers came today. It looks as though they are to see. Oh, you don't you know you're talking about this and mother's insane? Oh, you pretty things. Don't you know you're talking about this and mother's insane? Let me make it plain. Gotta make way for the home superior. Look out at your children. See their faces in golden rays. Don't kid yourself, they belong to you. They're the start of the common race. The earth is a bitch, we finished our news. Homo sapiens have outgrown their use. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, you pretty things. Don't you know the time when your love is a love and insane?
With insanity, extraterrestrial strangers come to stay, and everything else on Hunky Dory, you'd think that Bowie had played all his cards this time. But his biggest was yet to come. 2 or 3 weeks after the release of the album, he casually mentioned to a pop press reporter that he was bisexual. Always had been. Needless to say, it earned him huge headlines.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that went down very well, didn't it? It was a bit of a throwaway, but I stuck to my guns.
That was January 1972, but as Ken Pitt reminds us, there were quite a few people to whom the news was no news at all.
What people don't know is that one of the first major interviews that David gave was to a gay magazine called Jeremy. And it was one of the interviews that we were intending was going to launch him in some great style. One of the things I realized that there was a very, very strong homosexual and even larger bisexual underground that was going to emerge eventually, that was there for everybody to see. And where now everybody wants to get a write-up in gay news, in those days you didn't do such a thing, but David did. David was the first, and he had this big spread in Jeremy.
Jeremy magazine, good God, yeah, there were three copies out, wasn't it? Then it closed down. I remember Jeremy. Yeah, I did interviews with him. So it was an old statement by the time I made it, and I think actually the one thing about that statement was at least it was a tag that people could sort of identify. It gave me a category anyway, so I suppose it helped in that respect. Unfortunate, because there's so much more to me than that. But it was, no, I was, I think it was, in time it just, God knows how all that happened. I really don't know. When I got to America, it meant a lot more, and it was a much heavier statement over there. It became radical and very political in a way, because they were going through the gay lib thing at the time. So I was, you know, for the first couple of years, I had a heavy battle because it was hard to tell people that if that whole bisexuality thing was part of me, it wasn't necessarily part of the work I did, and that. Because I wore funny clothes on stage didn't mean that I was into drag, that it wasn't, they weren't drag clothes. But Americans don't appreciate the subtleties of dress as they do in Europe. And Europe, if you wear some funny clothes, and then it's seen as being part of the character you're playing. But in America, if you, especially at that time, if you wore anything that wasn't jeans, it was drag, which was the hardest problem I had in the States. It was to try to convince people that because I was a bisexual, that it didn't mean that everything I wrote about or did meant that it was all gay. But, you know, that bisexual thing was part of my private life, none of their business. And, that the songs and the albums and the stage performances were what I was all about. But it took a long time. It eventually, I mean, that was the biggest obstacle I had, was getting away from being put up there as some kind of token gay performer, you know.
Quite apart from the sensational headlines that his declared bisexuality brought him, Bowie had made an outstanding album in Hunky Dory. He'd managed, too, to include a song dedicated to someone he'd long admired.
He was an avid Andy Warhol fan. I mean, when I first met him in 1967, he was just singing the praises of Andy Warhol all the time. And, did I pronounce that right? Warhol, David. He's got a thing about it.
Warhol, actually. Hull. As in holes. What? Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol. Like Hull. Hull.
Dress my friends up just for show. See them as they really are. But the people in my brain, two new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
And Andy Warhol. That Funky Dory album featured once again the talents of Rick Wakeman on keyboard. Bowie had asked him to join the band, but Rick was getting very much busier as a musician, and as he was shortly to join Yes, he said no to David.
By that time, I suddenly started doing loads of sessions, about 3-4 a day, and you suddenly knew when you were on a session, you knew almost instantly whether you were going to have a hit or not. And you got to know the different arrangements and the different things and the different songs that way different people would write. I remember coming away from this just absolutely raving about it. I thought it had to be one of the hugest albums of all time. It just it had to be, because there just wasn't even a weakness on it. It got everything. It's got classics on it. I mean, Life on Mars is a classic. Changes is a classic.
It's a god-awful small affair. The girl with a mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walked through her sunken dream, through the street with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad and bore, but she's missed it 10 times or more. She could fit in the eyes of fools, but they ask her to throw the song.
Life on Mars was the impatient, bored, finger-drumming Bowie, waiting for something to happen, but still a little unsure of who or what he was.
Yeah, I couldn't come through at all. I didn't know who to be when I got out there. That was the big struggle, was wondering whether I should try and be me, or if I couldn't cope with that, then make up some people, and would I be them easier? And it was much easier to be somebody else, so I was somebody else, and then it worked better. So therefore, I must have been an actor. I thought, well, I'll be an actor. I say I'm an actor, and that gives me a reason for changing. And so I started as an actor, and then I came out with all these different guises. And that seems to be how it's evolved, really. And now I seem to be finding it much easier to get nearer to some kind of me. But I wonder, though, I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe I'm still acting up there.
Back in 1972, it was the gay tag that he was trying, at least in part, to shed, that accelerated him into adopting another role, one that he'd created and defined.
I'd wanted to be anybody but me, I think. And that's how Ziggy got started, you see. I thought, well, if I don't like being David Jones, then we'll think of somebody else to be for a bit. And we came up with Ziggy.
Changes was written, presented, and produced by Stuart Grundy. Next Saturday, the Gene Genie works his magic as David Bowie moves through the Aladdin sane phase and eventually becomes a diamond dog. David Bowie, the Gene Genie, next Saturday at 1.